Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, filling in for Ann this week. She's on vacation. It's nearly a decade since American astronauts were sent into orbit from U.S. soil, but that's going to change next year. After halting its space shuttle program in 2011, NASA announced last week that nine American astronauts, since dubbed the Commercial Crew 9, will blast off into space once again from the U.S. on an American-built ship. The astronauts will be the first to fly on private spacecrafts and will take four flights to the International Space Station. Managing editor of Space.com, Tariq Malik, has been covering the news. He recently was able to speak with astronauts who fly on NASA's mission. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Tariq.
Hello, Gail. Thanks for having us.
Why is NASA doing all of this now?
Well, so NASA, you know, they have not had their own vehicle or the ability to launch their own astronauts into space since 2011, when the final space shuttle Atlantis landed in July of that year. And, you know, NASA wants to do big things. They want to continue to send astronauts to the International Space Station on their own. They want to send people out into deep space to return to the moon, as President Trump has directed the agencies to do. And to do that, they decided they wanted to split things in half. NASA will focus on that deep space mission, but they'll take what commercial industry, what companies like SpaceX and Boeing can do to kind of contract that trip to low Earth orbit, to the space station, out. You know, NASA's been doing this for years with Russia, where they pay millions and millions of dollars per seat to fly astronauts on Russia's spacecraft. They want to do that kind of in-house in the United States.
So is that the big announcement from NASA? Because there have been other programs, projects that they've been working on, but this is the big one?
Well, you know what you mentioned earlier about, you know, it's been nearly a decade. This is kind of like the starting line now for these new spacecraft. Now, back in 2014, 3 years after the final space shuttle landed, that's when NASA said they're going to pick these companies, SpaceX and Boeing, to fly American astronauts back into space from the United States. But then, you know, a year later, they unveiled at least the first four astronauts they thought would begin training with those companies. Their commercial crew cadre is what they were known of. And now in 2018, they are saying, we've got the spacecraft built, SpaceX's Crew Dragon, Boeing's Starliner space capsule. We have the crews that will fly the first test missions in April and mid-2019 on those vehicles, and then the first crews after that will fly the operational missions to the space station. So it kind of got a lot more real when NASA made that announcement, and you saw these nine astronauts. One of them is a former NASA astronaut, Chris Ferguson, and he is a Boeing astronaut. He just happens to be the commander of the last space shuttle mission, now flying on Boeing's first test flight of this new private spacecraft. So it's kind of an interesting bridge there.
Basically, he was a NASA astronaut who retired and then went to work with Boeing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, that's not the only instance, though, of public and private with this project. This is the first time that commercial companies, not NASA, have built spacecraft?
You know, so NASA has been using commercial companies for the last about half decade or so to fly commercial cargo to the space station. Now, SpaceX is one of those companies. They built a robotic version of their Dragon space capsule that flies cargo to and from the space station to keep those astronauts supplied with food, air, other types of things, their scientific equipment. Another company, now it's Northrop Grumman Innovative Systems, but it was previously Orbital ATK, had been launching their own private spacecraft from the Virginia's eastern shore to the station to do that similar thing, to resupply. And NASA has also contracted another company, Sierra Nevada, and they've built a private space plane, a smaller version of the space shuttle, to also fly these robotic flights to the station. So they kind of had laid the groundwork for crew flights on private space taxis with those earlier contracts on the commercial side to kind of supply the space station, keep it stocked with everything those astronauts need. So it's kind of like a supply train that then led to this transportation service. And NASA hopes to kind of be the customer for other types of things. You know, if they're buying flights on these private vehicles, could they buy a trip to a private space station? There's a lot of projects that are underway on that side as well. And, you know, NASA has lofty dreams of returning people back to the moon. And if these private companies can make it cheaper or better than or faster than the agency, they will now actively explore that capability.
And financially better, I would think, for NASA to have partners like this.
Exactly. You know, now, SpaceX advertises their Dragon launches on Falcon rockets at, you know, somewhere between $60 and $70 million for the entire mission. And NASA's paying more than that per seat to Russia to fly one person into space. So, you know, these vehicles that Boeing and SpaceX will be flying NASA astronauts on can seat up to seven. NASA will likely use some of those seats for cargo, but you're getting many more seats for kind of the price they were paying.
Tarek, you were able to speak with some of the astronauts who are part of this commercial Crew 9, as they're being called. Who are they, and why do they want to do this?
Well, so it's really kind of a range of astronauts. Now, I mentioned earlier that the Boeing astronaut, Chris Ferguson, a former space shuttle astronaut and commander, he commanded STS-135. That was the final flight of the space shuttle program. And he will be on that first Boeing flight. So he kind of has been on the ground with Boeing's development of this vehicle, knowing what astronauts need. And then now he will be representing Boeing on that first flight. And joining him on that flight will be NASA astronaut Eric Bo, a veteran astronaut, and a new astronaut, Nicole Mann. Now, she's a test pilot with the U.S. Marine Corps. She's going to be making her first space flight with this. And, it's you know, she joined in 2013 thinking she might be flying on a Russian Soyuz vehicle. Now she's flying on a U.S. vehicle. She said she was really excited about that. They called it a test pilot's dream. On the SpaceX side, NASA astronauts Mike Hopkins and Victor Glover will fly the first operational flight to the station. That's the one that will come after the SpaceX test flight. That's Victor Glover is a new astronaut there, making his first flight, again, expecting to train on a Soyuz vehicle, and now he's flying on an American one. And Mike Hopkins, a veteran NASA astronaut, on the first test flight for that mission are two veterans. Bob Behnken is kind of the lead there, and they say that they're like a key team, the two of them together. It's a really interesting mix where you have these veteran astronauts and you have these new astronauts, and then these kind of this new breed of astronauts, the commercial corporate folks that, you know, could fly with NASA. They could fly on private flights in the future with space tourists. We're not sure where that will take them.
Mm. Tarek, earlier you mentioned some of the goals of teaming up with the commercial companies, sending people more financially, fiscally, not having to use the Russians, that we can do it ourselves, but also the goal of further out, which sounded really sci-fi to me. So the goal first is to get to the space station, but the second goal is bigger, broader?
Yeah. So you know, the initial goal with NASA is to kind of restore that American independent access to space, being able to launch our own astronauts and our partners, because NASA has obligations to its international partners, astronauts with Canada, with Europe, with others, to fly them to space as part of just the International Space Station Agreement. So that's the first goal, you know, have that independent access to space as a national priority. But, you know, NASA doesn't want to just stay in Earth orbit. It's been in Earth orbit since the last moon flight in the early 70s. So the Trump administration in December had directed NASA to return astronauts to the moon, you know, really to stay, to set up that infrastructure that you need to have a sustained beyond Earth orbit exploration. So you've got the moon as that first stop. Mars is a potential destination. Other deep space targets like the asteroid belt could come later. And to do that, NASA needs this commercial infrastructure in place to build the habitats that they're going to need, the vehicles. Now, NASA is building an Orion space capsule that is their new vehicle. Lockheed Martin is building that with NASA to fly astronauts on those deep space missions. But they're going to need companies to build the power systems for a habitat around the moon. They call it the Lunar Orbital Gateway project. They're going to need the modules that people are going to live in, the landers that people are going to land on the moon, and the new spacesuits to land on the moon.
That all sounds crazy.
So all of that stuff needs to be made. NASA does not have it now. And so all of this experience that NASA has gained from working with SpaceX, with Boeing on these commercial crew systems, you can see that evolving into that. You know, I mentioned spacesuits earlier. Boeing and SpaceX both have their own versions of spacesuits that these astronauts are going to wear. Instead of those kind of bright orange spacesuits you might recognize from the space shuttle era, SpaceX has this really sleek kind of white spacesuit. It almost looks like a sci-fi costume. Boeing has a really bright blue spacesuit that is very reminiscent of the jumpsuits that astronauts wear, but it's easier for them to get into and out of, something that the astronauts really said that they enjoyed as compared to their previous spacesuits. And those kinds of new technologies are going to be needed when we walk on the moon. We don't have moon spacesuits Mm-mm. anymore. And they were really bulky when the astronauts fell over on the moon, and they did. It was really hard for them to get back up. And if they really want astronauts to do really good science, really amazing exploration on the moon or on Mars, they're going to need new 21st century equipment, not just a rehash of what was done in the 70s and in the 60s. And these companies could be the most effective, affordable, and innovative ways to get there.
This is the first big news we've heard from NASA in a decade since the space shuttle program. What's NASA been doing? Has it been dormant? We haven't really heard much.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of the biggest news on the human spaceflight side. Now, NASA has kind of kept its presence in space on the International Space Station since then. They flew the longest duration mission of an American astronaut with Scott Kelly, that one-year mission, and along with a Russian cosmonaut. So that was like a big deal in the 2014-2015 timeframe. They kept that human presence on the space station. They've also been building additional parts of the station. They added a docking port, cameras, the things that they're going to need for these private spaceships to get there. And then at the same time, they've continued their exploration of the solar system and of deep space. Now they flew by Pluto in 2015. They're going to be landing on Mars again with the InSight Mars lander in November of this year. They've had actually the year after the shuttle retired, they landed the Mars rover Curiosity on Mars. And so, you know, they've had a lot of other things going on at the same time. The astronauts and the human spaceflight side gets a lot of attention, but those vehicles take a long time to develop. And so while they've been working on those in the background, working with these companies to figure out how they're going to fly on these new space capsules, they've been doing the science that, you know, really kind of they're known for and pushing that frontier as well.
Why did NASA's original program, the space shuttle, just shut down in 2011? Did they do that so that they could focus on new things?
Well, you know, it was kind of a mix. Now, in NASA's first space shuttle mission launched in 1981, and at the time, the space shuttle fleet was the most technically complex and the most versatile of the space vehicles at that time. Now, it's, you know, you can fit a bus in the payload bay of the space shuttle. The shuttle itself was reusable, and the vision was that they were going to be flying these things every 2 weeks and make spaceflight extremely affordable. And unfortunately, the reality was that the vehicles were extremely complex. They could not reach that 25 flight a year target they were hoping to. They flew maybe four or five times a year, and they were really expensive to build. And it's still, you know, a very capable spacecraft. They launched huge satellites into space. They were able to go up and retrieve satellites, bring them back, and advance science. That way, it was instrumental in building the International Space Station. But, you know, in 1986, the Challenger exploded during launch, and it exposed kind of how challenging a vehicle it was. And then in 2003, the space shuttle Columbia broke apart during reentry after suffering some damage on launch, and it showed that despite having, you know, 20-plus years of experience at that time, the shuttle was still a test vehicle, not as inherently safe as maybe a lot of the public might have thought, that these were routine flights. It was not like getting on an airplane. And so they decided in 2004 that they were going to retire the program in 2011 and replace that with a new 21st century spacecraft. And so that was kind of locked in to retire it after the end of the space station was, or after the space station was completed, the International Space Station, and then have a new vision. And in 2004, that was the Constellation program under the George W. Bush's administration. Unfortunately, that program was never fully funded, and so they weren't able to get that off the ground. And during the Obama administration, they changed tacks and tried to aim for an asteroid. All at the same time, the shuttle was winding down. It wasn't as safe as they wanted it to be, although since the Columbia accident in 23, every flight was inherently safer and more streamlined. By the end of 2011, NASA just did not have that replacement ready, but it did have to stop the program so that they could at least free up the funds that they would need for what that new program would be.
And that's what we're looking at now.
Exactly. Yeah. The Trump administration stopped that Obama's vision of sending astronauts to collect an asteroid, and now they're looking back at the moon.
Tarek Malik, thank you so much for being here.
Well, a pleasure. Thank you.
Tarek is the manager editor for space.com, and we'd like to hear what you think about space travel. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, filling in for Ann this week. NASA halted its space shuttle program in 2011. It's nearly a decade since American astronauts were sent into orbit from the U.S., but that's going to change next year. NASA announced last week that the 9 American astronauts will blast off into space once again from U.S. soil on an American-built ship. Today we're talking about the news from NASA, and what it means for the future of American space exploration. And of course, there's Space Force, which President Trump has touted since taking office.
I'm Robin Young, as our borders.
That is not President Trump, but he is touting Space Force. Joining us now is space and astronomy journalist and the publisher of Universe Today, Fraser Crane. Fraser, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone, also the author of Spaceport Earth and contributing editor at Popular Mechanics, Joe Pappalardo. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Welcome back. Thank you. And in the studio, we have astrophysicist at Ohio State University and chief scientist at COSI, author of the forthcoming book, Your Place in the Universe, Paul Sutter. Paul, welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Paul, I'll start with you. What did you think when you first heard NASA's announcement about the new commander crew and the 9 astronauts, and this is what we're going to do?
Yeah, when I heard the announcement, it was a mixture of excitement and skepticism. Whenever deadlines or expectations are set when it comes to space, I always internally push it back by at least a few months, more likely a few years. So is this crew exciting? Is the fact that we have the capability to go into space, is the public and private partnerships that we're developing when it comes to space exploration exciting? Yes, all of that. I love it. Will it happen next year? I'm not exactly going to place my bets on it.
But we're headed in the right direction.
We are headed in the right direction, which is up.
Of course you would say that. Fraser, your comments on the announcement from NASA, you probably saw some of this coming. What do you think of the future of this program?
Well, I mean, I think everyone who's been watching the space industry really carefully has been watching this all unfold in kind of achingly slow motion. So, you know, we've known about the Boeing Starliner and the SpaceX Crew Dragon vehicles and both of their attempts to get their equipment ready to be able to send astronauts back to the space station. And as Paul said, we've seen delays and timing get pushed back. And it feels to me like that this is the more realistic timeline now with NASA actually choosing some astronauts and setting some dates. So I would be a little more hopeful than Paul, but definitely skeptical as well. But still, it's exciting to see these spacecraft getting close to being able to launch.
Joe, as I was reading and preparing for this segment today, I came across a couple definitions: space travel, orbiter, suborbital. What's the difference?
A lot of the space program that private space efforts that people were looking at were focused on space tourism at first, so Virgin Galactic, and that was the first exposure that people got to commercial space, and now it's going to orbit. So, I mean, think of the suborbital as sort of as a jump shot. You get into space proper, you cross what they call the Kármán line, you get high enough, and you're in space. But an orbital shot, which is to launch satellites or to get to the space station with astronauts, for example, is a much more complicated, more dangerous, not just because of the cargo is more important, especially if it's people, but also the flight itself is a lot more difficult. And to me, I love suborbital. Don't get me wrong. You could do a lot of great science with suborbital flight. It's not just for rich people taking a trip, but orbital's where it's at. That's where the money is at. That's where the real human exploration part is at. So commercial space is really growing up into big space. I mean, SpaceX is already delivering satellites and other people with them are delivering crew cargo rather to the space station. So they're doing orbital stuff, but this is human space flight to orbit. This is the real deal. So it's a real graduation of what we're expecting from these companies.
Paul, he mentioned commercial space travel, and I know there have been others who have they're already starting. They want to use it as for the very wealthy, the ultimate vacation. Are we far from that reality?
It's always hard to judge timelines because going into space is kind of hard, as Joe mentioned, and very expensive. And there's a huge difference.
And risks.
That's exactly right. There's a huge difference between sending cargo into space and sending people into space. It's much harder to send people into space. There's a lot more things like air and food that we need to include in the spacecraft. We need to account for soft, fleshy human bodies that we don't need to worry about when it comes to cargo. And so there's a lot more risks. It's a lot more expensive. We have to be a lot more careful, rightly so, when it comes to sending people into space than just cargo. Usually when we think of space, like Joe mentioned, we think of orbital. We think of astronauts orbiting the Earth in the space station or the space shuttle. The first steps when it comes to space tourism will be these suborbital flights where you just pop up on a rocket, go 60 miles above the surface of the Earth.
Have a really good view.
Amazing. You can see your house from there. And then you come back down. That is definitely realistically possible with millionaire budgets on expensive vacations that they like to enjoy.
Fraser, Paul brought up that safety attitude. There have been some that have argued that NASA is almost too cautious, and that's preventing NASA from doing bigger things. What do you think about that?
Well, NASA learned some very powerful lessons about how dangerous spaceflight is with the Challenger disaster and the Columbia disaster. Two crews were entirely lost, and the lessons learned from those accidents are not lost on everybody who works on this next round of spacecraft. And in fact, the safety concerns are definitely one of the biggest reasons why the timelines for these new spacecraft have been pushed back. There are a bunch of safety requirements that both Boeing and SpaceX have to be able to fulfill to prove that their new spacecraft are ready to fly and carry human beings up to the International Space Station. And they are essentially trying to prove that they are as safe and as successful as the Russian Soyuz spacecraft, which has been doing the same job for like decades and decades and carrying astronauts into space. So making sure that the safety issues are in line is really one of their top priorities.
Joe, what about Boeing? They're a big player here. They're one of those commercial companies that's trying to prove that they can be safer. Anybody else in the picture?
Well, in this particular competition. There are only the two of them to get to the space station. They have the contract. They have all the pressures on those two to do it. But there are certainly others. I mean, Blue Origin has a human spaceflight program that is pretty well under wraps, but they're building big rockets and spacecraft to bring people into orbit as well as their suborbital effort, which is chugging along pretty well also. So then in terms of the orbital component, those are the ones to sort of keep an eye on in the short term, at least in the United States. There's the Chinese and Japanese and European programs all sort of are following following along as well. Everyone wants to get new spacecraft up, but right now it's really on Boeing and SpaceX. And when you concentrate on those programs, safety is not just a catchphrase or a bureaucracy or check marks. There's actual cultural differences between the way NASA does things and, for example, the way SpaceX does things. The way they load the fuel while their astronauts are still on board, that's something NASA is extremely worried about, especially since SpaceX blew a rocket up while they were fueling it on the launch pad. So they have to prove that system works. They have to prove that some of the components inside, they have these high-pressure composite pressurized vessels that have caused trouble, and by trouble, I mean loss of a rocket and the payload. Previously, they have to fly those and prove to NASA that those components work. So there's a certain, they're going through a lot, and that's just SpaceX. I mean, Boeing has their problems, too, that they've discovered during testing. So as this process goes along, it's not just, clashing bureaucracies. These are engineers who are sitting in a room trying to prove that their systems work. And a lot of that is going to make the companies and NASA work more closely together. Not to be too Pollyannish about it, but
they'll have
the way
to.
That the culture, yeah, they have to. This is right. That the culture changes and the way that we get a little bit more ambitious. And no one wants to have an accident that could derail everything for everyone. You lose an astronaut during during this program. It's going to color the entire process moving forward. So. They're in a position where they have to go fast because we're going to have to rent more rides from the Russians. That's politically unpalatable and going to be financially difficult as well, since it's not budgeted. No one wants to do it. But at the same time, they have to get it off safely. So there's a lot of pressure to do this right. And in my opinion, it's better to do it right a little more slowly than to rush it through and have a catastrophic accident.
Okay, Joe, we're going to take a call from Dan. Dan, your question or comment, please.
Yes, I was just wondering what kind of remediation efforts can be enacted to ensure that there is a cross-administration unity of vision. For example, back in 2003, the Columbia Accident Investigation Board discovered that one of the main problems was that whenever a new administration comes in, there is a entirely new roadmap forward. So that ends up hindering the overall space program advancement. Any good ideas on that?
Paul, I'm going to look to you for this one.
Yeah, this is definitely a problem. And this is a problem with NASA that is not just isolated to manned and crewed exploration of space. This is a problem across NASA for all of their scientific and research endeavors as well, is that every time there's a new administration, so every 4 years, sometimes even every 2 years, there's a whole new plan, not just for exploration of space, but also the scientific investigation of space. And so entire projects that have been ramped up are now scaled back. Entire divisions that are working towards a goal are now reassigned and split up or merged. And this hampers their ability to enact long-term plans. And the inability to enact long-term plans means things get lost in the shuffle, like critical safety evaluations. And one of the best things that we have going for us that is hopefully going to work around this, not necessarily solve it, but work around it, is the involvement of private companies. When it comes to space, the leaders of SpaceX, the leaders of Boeing, they're just beholden to their shareholders, to their board of directors. And as long as the shareholders and board of directors are on board with a long-term, multi-year, possibly multi-decade timescale vision, they have the resources and the ability to commit to that long-term vision.
Well, they've made the announcement that this, I think, is going to be it's set in stone that these nine American astronauts are going to start to go up into space with these on these private spaceships. Could that be hampered by a new administration, or because it's already in the pipeline, it'll go forward?
It can totally be hampered by a new administration, by a new budget, new line items. A new administration could just decide, nah, never mind. Or the current administration could decide, nah, never mind.
Fraser, this does appear to be a shot in the arm for NASA, though, who has publicly, at least, looked pretty dormant for the past decade.
Do you mean like getting these nine astronauts?
Correct. Yes, a big announcement. Yes, that we're sending more astronauts into space when we hadn't heard or seen much from at least the astronaut perspective.
Well, I mean, there have been astronauts continuously on the International Space Station now since its construction back was wrapped up, or since it was habitable back in the early 2000s. So, I think although there aren't these gigantic, exciting announcements like humans walking on the moon or people being sent to Mars or people going on astronauts, there has been this continuous presence in space on board the International Space Station doing experiments. But, I totally get they're just going around in orbit, around and around and around, and that is, not as exciting as potentially as humans walking on the moon. So I think it's that next series of announcements that the Trump administration is making about the future plans to potentially build a different space station closer to the moon, to be sending astronauts back to the moon and using that as a stepping stone onto Mars, which is starting to really capture people's imagination.
We're going to switch gears when we come back and talk about the Space Force, which is something that President Trump has been talking about recently. And we'd also like to hear from you, so give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, filling in for Ann this week. NASA is back in business. It's nearly a decade since American astronauts were sent into orbit from the U.S. after shutting down the space shuttle program in 2011. That's going to change next year. NASA announced last week that nine American astronauts will blast off into space again from U.S. soil and on American-built ships. This hour, we're talking about the news and what it means for the future of American space exploration. Still with us, space and astronomy journalist and the publisher of Universe Today, Fraser Cain, author of Spaceport Earth and contributing editor at Popular Mechanics, Joe Pappalardo, and astrophysicist at OSU, chief scientist at COSI, the author of the forthcoming book, Your Place in the Universe, Paul Sutter. Thank you all for remaining with us. And as I mentioned before the break, we're going to talk about Space Force. Fraser, I'm going to ask you what this means, whose idea this is. We've heard President Trump talk about it. And my initial reaction was this was something that in a tweet, he thought up in the middle of the night. But apparently it's a legitimate program, possibly.
Well, for starters, I like the name Starfleet better, but maybe that's just my Star
Paul
Trek.
Said the same thing. He goes, I don't like the name
it's
Space
so
Force.
It's so 80s. It's so 80s.
Yeah.
So let's start there, right?
But sure. Yeah, so I mean, the idea of having a separate branch of the U.S. military that is focused on space operations is an idea that's been kicking around for a while. And actually, about a year ago or so, Congress had the military consider what it would take to separate out the chunks of the Air Force that are already doing space operations. But the reality, of course, is that the United States and really all of the nations out there are militarizing space as much as they can, as much as makes sense, and as much as is permitted by the Outer Space Treaty. So the U.S., for example, has reconnaissance satellites and communication satellites and the GPS system. They have their own space plane called the X-37B that nobody knows what it does. It's up there right now. So there is already a tremendous amount of militarization and people within the Air Force and other branches of the military that are involved in space-based military operations. So the question really is there new hardware, missions, things like that, or is this just an organizational shift in that you create a new branch, move people who used to be in the Air Force in the space operations, and they're over now in the Space Force, and so it's these details that we just don't know yet.
There seems to be a conflict about what agencies should monitor space. At this point, it has been the Air Force, and Paul, you had mentioned this is where Space Force comes in, where they would take some of those responsibilities from the Air Force. So we really don't know what's happening there.
Yeah, exactly. And also the National Reconnaissance Office, which is the one of the big space spy agencies for the United States, has a big presence in space. In fact, they donated 2 telescopes that they didn't need anymore to NASA. And those telescopes are going to be part of future research missions led by NASA. So who the heck knows what they've got going on up there?
Joe, I am not sure that people realize how much reconnaissance militarily goes on with these satellites. It's more than people realize, I think.
It's the backbone to everything. Every battlefield advantage that the United States enjoys is pretty much dependent on space. From communication, we talk about GPS. I mean, it's not just civilians that are dependent on that now. It's pretty much everything, guidance, again, communication. And the idea that our satellites are vulnerable is something that's very new to the Pentagon. It's something that for example, the Chinese and the Russians have put in a good amount of research and development into things that can disrupt, jam, or even shoot down. And by that, I just mean a strong enough laser to disrupt the operations of that physical operations of the satellite. They're working on these things. So they have these ground-based weapons that that can hold this high ground at risk, and that's a very new thing for the Pentagon. And they've been pretty slow compared to the, if it's a cat and mouse, those satellites are the mice, and they're not really – they hadn't worked on the defenses as quickly as other people have been working on the offense. So there's a big feeling at the Pentagon now that there's a gap in between those capabilities, right? So the Space Force would be the way to hone and concentrate that effort in a coherent way to meet these challenges. And the idea is the bureaucratic shakeup going to be worth the advantages to that when you can just do it with funding, or you can do it with career development and some of the unsexy things that the Pentagon can do to make this effort a little bit more robust. And Space Force may be a little bit too much, but at least people are now talking about the problem,
I'm going to play some sound now from President Trump, who has been focused on space for a little bit.
When it comes to defending America, it is not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space.
So speaking of that dominance, there are some who say that we should pull out of the space station program, I think as early as 2020. Am I right, Paul?
Something like that.
And others that want to even sign proposals in Congress to keep us on that space station as long as it's viable. What's the yin and yang of that?
The space station is one of the most expensive things we as a human species have ever done.
But isn't this what the president's talking about, like in that quote, space dominance? Would we give that up?
If we were to give up the space station, I honestly don't think, and Joe and Fraser could correct me, I don't think the International Space Station plays a major role in the defense posture of the United States. It's more of a research program of studying how we can live long term in low gravity environments, of investigating the properties of materials and biology in low gravity environments, and various atmospheric phenomena and space phenomena that we study from that. It's more of a research installation than a military installation. But like Joe mentioned, the constellation of satellites that we have, that we rely on and that our military relies on for communication, for coordination, for spying, for mapping, for everything that makes a modern industrial state and military power an industrial state and military power, that's where I think President Trump is focusing in terms of dominance.
Mm-hmm. And Fraser, this is a real concern. You call it war in space?
Well, I mean, there is a, as I mentioned earlier, there's the Outer Space Treaty, which is a treaty signed by most of the nations on Earth that defines what can and can't be done in space. And it's pretty clear that you can't put, say, nuclear weapons in space. You can't, you know, it really defines the limits of how much you can put weapons of mass destruction and things like that in space. But as Joe said, right, it's about keeping your satellites operational. It's about defending your satellites from someone who's attempting to take them down. Joe mentioned lasers, but in fact, the Chinese have also tested out anti-satellite missile systems. So they actually took down one of their own satellites with a ground-based missile, so proving that they can take out satellites when they want. And the U.S. and the Russians probably have the same capabilities as well. So what Trump is imagining and talking about things like dominance in space is going to run into the limits set by the Outer Space Treaty. And I think that's where the rubber is really going to hit the road, is the U.S. going to continue to abide by the limits of this treaty, or will they look to renegotiate the treaty, or will they look to step away from the treaty? So this is, again, where we need to see more details about specifically what the U.S. wants to do, and that will help define what the future of, like, the militarization of space is going to look like.
And, you know, Paul, you brought up the experiments on the space station. I've always wondered, can you give me examples? You gave me a little bit, but who's paying for some of these, and is any of the public going to benefit from any of these things? I mean, obviously, how my body reacts to, you know, the laws of gravity might not be important if I'm living here on Earth.
Right. It may not be important if you're living here on Earth, but if we're looking to long-term presence in space, to having colonies on the moon, to sending missions to Mars, you know, a mission to Mars, minimum round trip is 2 years. Most of that spent in a very low-gravity environment. Can humans survive for 2 years in a low-gravity environment? Open question we actually have to answer, and we're working hard to answer. Who pays for it? The International Space Station is very international. It's largely funded by NASA, the United States government, but there are many international partners that send astronauts up, that help fund parts of it, and it's all answering these very basic, fundamental biological questions that we have absolutely no experience of here on Earth.
Very true. Colonization, Joe, I mean, this really does sound like Star Trek stuff to me. How probable, possible are we talking about? And I'm not even going to ask how long it will take, but really this is something that seems all eyes at NASA are geared toward.
It's the big dream is to get get humans off the planet, and into the only way to really safeguard the species is to get off the planet. I mean, that's sort of the thinking du jour of certainly of some of the billionaires who are putting money into their own sort of colonization programs. But the one of the things that NASA did study on the space station was the way that sperm reacts to low and zero gravity, because NASA knows that there's not a lot of great data to support the idea that people can breed off the planet and animals. So they put the bull and human sperm into space, but this has just happened a couple of weeks ago, actually, so we don't even know what the results are yet, to see how sperm reacts and can they, you know, fulfill their biological function. So we're filling in these gaps in knowledge of what would be required to survive this trip and to survive other places. And there's a lot of work that can be done here on Earth, and suborbital and orbital work that can be done to fill those gaps. But some of that research actually benefits people on Earth also. I mean, the space station is the premier place to see how organisms react off the planet, but they, like the sperm study could help on fertility research down here, because you're learning more about how the biological process that affect the way that sperm operate. There are protein crystal growth in low gravity and zero gravity. You can see things about protein crystals, which is incredibly important in terms of on Earth terrestrial medicine. Doesn't have great applications in space, but it's just the best environment to see what's going on, because the crystals grow more uniformly in space, and you can really see the structure of the protein. So there are things that are happening in space that have direct benefits to us Earthlings down here. So it's not all about colonization and exploration in space. Most of it is, and the stuff that we like to talk about it certainly fits that goal. But there's a lot of other, and it's not really mundane. It's stuff that can really that big pharma can use to make new drugs that can help people on Earth. So there's a little bit of both. But yeah, colonization is especially what Bezos and Musk talk about, and now increasingly this administration, you know, the going to the moon and then hopscotching to Mars is a colonization scheme. I mean, everyone keeps saying we're going to put boots on these planets and these moons and we're going to stay there. Easier said than done. If we don't have the backup research, it's never going to happen. So these are really important stepping stones to that ultimate effort, that generational effort.
Well, Fraser, speaking of stepping stones, as Paul just mentioned, it would be moon first, then Mars, apparently. Have we come to the conclusion that we can't live on the moon, but if we can't get to the moon and do anything there, we're not going to get to Mars?
Right. Well, I mean, which way to go is again, an argument that happens, and there's some people who say the moon is just not worth going to in the first place, and you should send people directly to Mars, that we have a capability to do that now. Other people feel like the moon, because it's close, really because it's close, and is a great way to go first, because you can test out ideas, and if there's problems, you can send resupply missions, and they can get there within just a couple of days, and you can learn a bunch of those lessons about living in space. And then other people feel like we should just live in space itself, that building space stations like the International Space Station and then building them up, adding rotating sections that will provide artificial gravity, things like that, those will provide the stepping stones. And others feel like we should go to asteroids first. So even what is the next best target for humans to go after is still a point of argument. And this is one of the reasons why you've seen the directions shift from Congress, administration after administration. So we're going to the moon, we're going to Mars, we're going to asteroids, we're going to the moon. And it's that shifting in priorities that actually has pushed the whole program back, because each different, whatever your goal is, you need to create specific hardware that's going to take you to that location. So right now, the Trump administration is planning to continue building a space station that's going to be closer to the moon, to eventually have humans walk on the moon again and use that as a stepping stone to go to Mars. But if the administration changes, I wouldn't be surprised to see everything shift around again to a new direction.
Wow. My head is spinning, Paul. I mean, honestly, I know we're not talking about anything my generation, the next generations. I mean, we are really talking far out stuff.
This all sounds like science fiction.
It really does.
But imagine talking to someone from 100 years ago and having a conversation saying, yeah, we went to the moon.
and it was okay.
It was nice.
we bounced around.
And we stopped. And now we're trying to decide whether to go back or to go somewhere else. And we're having this little chit-chat debate about it. Going forward out 100 years, 200 years, of course, anything is possible with enough time. There's no law of physics that prevents us from going out into space. But there are serious, serious technological and engineering challenges for long-term presence in space. They're not impossible to solve, but they are very difficult to solve. That's why it's very, very hard to put timescales on these sort of things. Could we plausibly have someone walking around on Mars within a few decades? Yeah, that's a reasonable extension of our current technology. Could we have a colony of a couple thousand people living on Mars in the next few decades? Probably not. Could we have spinning habitats or inflatable habitats orbiting the Earth with a few dozen people living on there at a time in a few decades? Yeah, probably. It's pretty reasonable, actually. The future is now.
Real quick, who's going to get there first, NASA or billionaires like Branson?
I think billionaires.
But not Branson.
Not Branson. Other billionaires.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting, because he's the one who talks about it a lot. Anyway, it's a very interesting topic, and I won't be around to see it, but we will. Others will be around to see where we go with it. Thank you all so much for being here. Paul Sutter, an astrophysicist at Ohio State University and the chief scientist at COSI. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Joe Papalardo, author of Spaceport Earth and contributing editor at Popular Mechanics. Joe, thanks again.
Keep watching the skies.
Yeah, and Fraser Kane, publisher of Universe Today. Fraser, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you. This is our hour. We'll be back for the next hour. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And all the children do get.